Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Okay, so welcome to the Midweek Takeaway. Today we have Charles, who's just explained that he's a super duper analyst and he's tipped lots of stocks to do more than 100%. So maybe this is going to be another one. And we have Peter Krugel, a long-known guest of Mast Energy. So I'll leave it up to you guys to discuss the most recently written article by Charles about Mast Energy.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Charles. Very good on you. And yes, good to chat.
Yeah, good to chat to you, sir. Yeah. So, you know, just for people who maybe haven't heard of Mast Energy Developments before or that maybe don't know your background, can you just give just a very kind of brief overview of like what you've done in your life, what kind of led you to like leading Mast and what the company does in like very simple, broad terms?
Okay, good. I'm a chartered accountant by training. I started out in the auditing industry and then moved over to the corporate side, pension funds initially. Then I started getting involved in wealth management and financial planning. I studied to be a certified financial planner and looked after high net worth individuals for a number of years. And I then joined the capital markets on the London Stock Exchange. That was about 10 years ago. I joined a company called Kibo Energy PLC. At that time, they were transitioning from a mineral exploration company to an energy development company. And one of the projects which we looked at and acquired was actually Mast Energy Developments at that time. It was a very early startup business model, which we very much liked. We liked the UK exposure. We liked the niche it was filling in the UK market. We felt that it was a critical part of the UK energy mix, which proved to be right. And then that was separately spun out of Kibo onto a separate standalone listing in 2021. And that brings us to Mast is today. So Mast today specializes in what they call flexible generation. So we fill in the gaps between baseload generations, specifically intermittent renewables. So if the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine, which it doesn't 365, you know, we come in and we fill that gap. So at the moment we do low carbon gas generation, which we feel there's still quite a bit of a runway on, but we also do battery energy storage solutions as well as solar, which will become part of that flexgen mix increasingly going forward.
So I mean, with flexible power generation that you were just describing, can you explain why it's critical as we transition, you know, the government's ambition for net zero, whether achievable or not, we are moving as a world more towards renewables. So why is flexible power generation critical?
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good question. And I mean, kind of the premise of our business model. So if we look back historically, baseload generation was of course applied by carbon fuels, predominantly coal in the UK.
Yeah.
And as that was phased out, and I mean the last coal power station in the UK was decommissioned last year, so the UK's got zero coal generation any longer. That was replaced with alternative renewable baseload generations, predominantly wind in the UK. So the challenge with renewable generation is that it is intermittent. So the wind doesn't blow 365. So and you can't replace that with solar, because the main requirement for baseload generation is inertia. And the only way to get inertia being, you know, the frequency to sustain the baseload of the national grid, is you need a turbine. So solar is not going to give you that inertia. Batteries are not going to give you that inertia. Only a turbine can. So wind is a very good solution in the UK, but it is intermittent. And that's where we come in. So if there's a drop in wind or a drop in sun, we step in and we generate typically during high demand periods or extreme weather patterns. So typically on a daily basis, we generate early mornings, late afternoons, between 4 and 8 hours, depending on the day. And also in kind of extreme weather conditions. We saw that in January, the weather condition situation. So there was an extreme cold snap across the entire Europe.
I remember, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So that was an absolute Goldilocks situation for us, because that also increased our demand and energy prices significantly. But I mean, just on a daily basis, there's a critical need for us. And that need, you know, is also partially filled at the moment by baseload gas generators such as OCGT and CCGT plants.
Yeah.
But those will be phased out. The government's been clear on that. Their target is moving. Yes.
Yeah, well, when they say phase out, they mean, you know, the next parliament's problem generally.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, in due course, that'll be phased out. But I mean, I think it's widely expected, and the government's been clear that flexible generation, including gas, is a critical part of the UK energy mix and will have to remain so, mainly to avoid blackouts.
Well, this is the thing, right? Because half of Western Europe went on blackouts, you know, in the early summer. People forget, you know, this is the kind of problems that we're going to have going forward as we transition to renewables. And when we talk about like energy sources as well, in terms of like cleanliness or net zero or like clean energy, people can't, a lot of individuals equivalent coal, lignite coal, with oil, with gas, when actually gas is significantly cleaner than those other sources. And, you know, I mean, in the UK, I mean, I guess it's kind of like a broader question that's not mass related, but I've always thought that hydropower would make the most sense because it is constant and we're an island surrounded by sea. Do you know why we don't put any effort into hydropower at all in the UK? Can you make a guess?
We've looked into that because, I mean, for us and our business model, it's very important to understand how we fit into the wider energy mix.
Yeah.
You know, so we really need to understand wind, we need to understand solar, we need to understand hydro, and as well as nuclear. So the hydro question, I think the main reason there is capex. So it is very capex intensive. So it makes the investment case for hydro in the UK, I think, challenging. I think that's the main reason why there hasn't been significant investment in hydropower in the UK.
But then the thing is, for me, again, I haven't looked at the figures in depth, but when you have intermittent power like wind and solar, then the capex is not just the solar panels or the wind turbines. It's also all of the infrastructure, which is obviously what you're targeting, which comes with its own capex costs and requirements that I don't think that have been properly thought through, how expensive that's going to be as well.
Yes,
but,
agreed.
You know, in terms of, you know, the business model and the strategy, you operate basically using containerized gas reciprocating engines. There's various technologies on the market. Why did you pick that one as your like flagship technology over the alternatives?
So the gas recip engines, I think, you know, mainly for us is a proven technology. It's been around for many years. You know, it's not novel. There's no teething problems. So it's proven, firstly. Secondly, there's very, very solid support in the UK for the engines that we use. So our preferred OEM is either Jenbacher out of Austria, which is a leading manufacturer and supplier of recip gas turbines. And more recently, we're going with Rolls-Royce engines. The reason for the shift to Rolls-Royce is...
Because they're the Rolls-Royce?
Because they're the Rolls-Royce. Now,
yeah.
Now, historically, you know, as with the Rolls-Royce car, that came at a significant premium. But Rolls-Royce had a new CEO recently. There's been a shift in the business. They're doing very well across the board, a share price at historic highs, and they're also focusing on their turbine business, and we can very clearly see that. So they're much more competitive now in terms of pricing and local support in the UK, and, you know, we are happy to support a fellow UK business.
Well, it's fair, yeah. I mean, Rolls-Royce is one of the stocks I did incredibly well on, buying the shares in the low in the pandemic, as did many others, because, you know, this is a company that obviously it had some debt, but that debt wasn't going to get paid off for a long time. The planes were eventually going to go back in the sky. But also you have, you know, Turbo CEO in charge, and obviously shift changed that business up northwards, which is, you know, an incredible opportunity. I mean, personally, I think that something that Rolls-Royce should entertain, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but a spin out of the small modular nuclear reactors.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That's the kind of IPO that would jumpstart the London markets. You know,
yes.
Aside from anything else. I mean, would you agree that's something that we need to see in the UK maybe?
Yes, absolutely. I agree with that. I mean, just kind of talking about that is, I think, you know, that there's a focus on modular nuclear globally. And, you know, a company is going to be the first on that. And I think Rolls-Royce is kind of looking at that. I think they've made that intention clear, whether or not they're going to move quick enough and structure it the right way, as you say, likely with a separate spin-out. That's going to be the question.
This is a regulation, isn't it? I mean, they're already getting cracking in Poland. In the UK, we're still at the committee stage and years away, regardless of what anyone says. But moving back to Mars, sorry, I could talk about roles for years. But You've got this three-phase strategic plan, right, according to this website. So phase one, establishing the gas reciprocating business model. This is through PyBridge, right, which is now established and the business model is proven. At currently, you're scaling operations up to 300 or more megawatts. That's the focus, so brownfield, greenfield, AI data centers. And then phase three, going beyond that, diversifying energy solutions. So could you just, phase one, I think basically we want to talk through the phases. So phase one, phase two, phase three. Basically, this is the business strategy for the next sort of 3 to 5 to maybe 7 years, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So yes, phase one, I think the foundation has been laid solidly now and has been proven specifically with PyBridge. So PyBridge, I think, is a very exciting success story for us. You know, we started out with PyBridge, you know, having a lot of challenges, kind of a tough nut to crack, but that nut has been cracked now. You know, we've successfully refurbished two of the three gen sets on site. That's been running smoothly for the first one for close on a year now. The numbers there are very much in line with expectation and is proving the, you know, the economic thesis. And that's kind of, you know, that's our brownfield strategy now, is to duplicate the success that we've had at Bridge by acquiring existing already constructed sites that requires limited overall work, limited capital investment, and much quicker to income generation. So that's our first strategy. And then in tandem with that, also greenfield sites. So historically, we acquired greenfield sites from third-party developers. But we said, well, I mean, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. We have the experience to develop these sites ourselves. So let's start doing that. So we are now developing our own greenfield sites from scratch up until shovel-ready stage and then going into construction and then production. And on the development costs, we believe we can do it for 1/5 of the total cost of acquiring it from a third party. So there's a significant saving to be had.
Yes.
We can also do it quicker. And more importantly, you know, we can develop the sites in the most attractive demand zones in the UK. So I think that's quite a gap in the market. So, I mean, the market shifts from time to time, and we've seen that third-party developers are not developing these projects in the most attractive demand areas in the UK, which we are now doing.
That's really, really helpful. And then in terms of the revenue streams, I think basically you've got four main income sources. But can you talk me through that and also how they're diversified? So one part of the business, you know, potentially isn't doing so well. Another part might be generating more revenue.
Yes. So each site has got the benefit of these four income streams. So each site in itself is already diversified. So the most attractive component of a site's income makeup is the capacity market contract. And the counterparty there is the UK government. Mm. So it is backed by the UK government and not only by a contract. So as opposed to contracts for difference for wind turbines, which is an actual contract with a counterparty. And as with any normal contract, that can be terminated or defaulted on. The capacity market is actually written into law. And the counterparty there is the energy of the Secretary of State for Energy. So it is probably the firmest agreement that you'll get.
It's basically a gilt, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, as long as you develop, 100%. As long as you deliver your side of the contract.
100%. 100%. Yeah. Exactly. And we've seen an uptick in the tariffs on the capacity market contracts, which is very good. You know, the recent auctions has cleared around £60,000 per megawatt annum. So I mean, that's great. And that provides you with around 50% of the total gross profit per site, and you know, which is guaranteed. So it covers your capex mostly, it covers your opex. It also makes the project very bankable. Banks love a capacity market contract. So that's the capacity market contract side of
it. It's easy to lend against it, isn't it?
Yes, basically? Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then, so with PyBridge, obviously, I'm not sure if you referred to it as this, but I mean, in my mind, it's basically your proof of concept site.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But I'm guessing while you were building it out, problems arose, issues in all engineering projects. So were there any lessons there that you learned from the operation as you were building it, as it's going so far, and what you might want to take forward to the next projects as you build out?
Yes. I think the biggest benefit for us, you know, of the PyBridge Experience is exactly that, the experience we gained from that. So the lessons learned, what to do, what not to do. It was our first attempt at this. I think as a first attempt, it went very well. So maybe just a step back. So interestingly, when we acquired BioBridge, you know, a typical brownfield project, it was an existing site already constructed, but it had very old engines on site. And we did not know at that time, this was actually before my time, before I took over as CEO, the business didn't know what the run hours and the history on those engines were. So I think an assumption was made, which was probably not correct, is that those engines got a bit of life left in them and we can run them for a while to get the proof of concept and then consider further capital investment, which turned out not to be the case. I mean, those engines started giving problems from day one. You know, when I took over and we worked out the deal with Riverford to get the necessary capex in to get those engines overhauled, that's when BioBridge really started sparking, you know, so to speak. So the overall process went very well. And I mean, there's a reason why we did it in a step approach. You know, we started with one engine, we completed that perfectly. And then once we did that, we copied and pasted that process onto the second engine, which was quicker, cheaper, you know, there were cost efficiencies. And we've got that down now. So those lessons are learned, and we've got that cookie cutter, so to speak, to apply to a next brownfield site.
And again and again.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, some of the critics of Mars, you know, basically they point to relatively low utilization hours at PyBridge. How do you respond to that, basically?
So as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, you know, we run between 4 and 8 hours per day, depending on the day and the season and whatnot. And we're not supposed to run more than that. You know, we're very much a standby power generator.
If you're running 24/7, there's a problem.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the most we've run up to now was in January, you know, when there was kind of a Goldilocks scenario, and that's kind of 12 hours a day. That's kind of the most that we'll ever run. Technically, we can. The gensets are able to run 24/7, but I mean, that comes with a lot of repercussions. You know, to a certain extent, we also trade the margin between the gas price and the electricity price, and that's not always favorable. So, you know, we typically generate when there's the necessary margin to be had between the two, and our target is 30%. So we won't run if we don't get that margin. So that's kind of an important factor for us, as well as the more the engines run, the more your operations and maintenance costs are over the course of a year. So all of that's very finely balanced for us to get the most profit out of the engines. And that doesn't mean running the most hours.
No, because the margins slip. And the cost of OPEX, basically, of maintenance goes up.
Yes.
It was fully funded for a project level partnership. Presumably, these are going to be quite important financing structures as you grow. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So our funding partner there is PowerTree, and that's a joint venture between Balancing Services and HardTree. HardTree being the giant corporate trading company, and they also trade electricity in the UK. So very interestingly, that's a new source of capital for these projects, which we're seeing. So historically, these projects, being infrastructure type projects, have typically been funded by infra type funds. But we're seeing new sources of capital coming to the table, which is very encouraging to see, such as HardTree. So, I mean, HardTree trading the energy has said, listen, you know, why don't we also get a dog in the hunt? And they're partnering with companies like us to do that. So they come in, they provide the capital. The benefit for us is no further funding obligation. We retain a significant stake in the project, and you know that's a project sorted.
Yeah, good. And then in terms of when you're selecting projects, obviously you're pursuing greenfield developments and brownfield acquisitions. What are the advantages and disadvantages of each? Kind of when you're assessing them in the office, which would you prefer to do primarily, or is it good to have a mix?
So for us, a mix, absolutely, because as you say, each has got its own pros and cons. I think from you know, on balance, it's really a lifetime question. So I mean, a brownfield's like buying a secondhand car. You know, there's a limited lifetime on that asset, and on a brand new car, you know, it's got a few more years, but you pay more. So I mean, we've crunched the numbers, and on balance, over a 10-year period, both return pretty much the same. You know, it's from, if you go 15 year, 20 years, then it becomes a different story. But you know, we're focused on the next 10 years. And we believe that a mix of the two is the best for us because, I mean, the brownfields projects, it's a lower investment cost. It's quicker to income generation. For the first 10 years, you're sorted. And after that, you start looking at further capital investment as opposed to a greenfield project. It's more capital intensive. It takes a bit longer to start generating income, but you're going to have an extra 5 years at the end. But, you know, if we look at it on balance, you know, it's kind of the same over a 10 plus year period. And that's the reason why we're doing both at the same time.
Excellent question. So basically, same. The same in terms of the actual financial outcome, the same in the
Yes.
end. In terms of sort of that financial performance, because you touched on it, you recently reported revenue growth 260%. Could you just describe what's driving this acceleration? Is it just simple business growth? And in terms of revenue streams, you know, revenue growth going forward, how secure are they? And do you think you're going to see similar levels of percentage increases in revenue growth going forward?
Yes, yeah. So our revenue growth up to now has been very much an increase in our megawatts in production. So that's our main focus and main driver. So with each megawatt we add in production, you know, that revenue is going to increase correspondingly. But also, you know, it is market related. But, you know, the good thing there is if we look at our past 12 months' performance, it's very much in line with expectations. So we didn't underperform our expectations or overperform. You know, we hit a 30% gross profit margin, which is bang on exactly what we're looking for. So that's great. And that gives a very good indication of what we can expect going forward. You know, so it's very simple is, you know, take that per megawatt and multiply it by our ambition of 300 megawatts, which is our first target. And it's really down to that. The makeup of our income and our gross profit, as we said, the you know a significant portion of that is the capacity market, which is guaranteed. The other part of that, which makes up a big part, is merchant trading for our power purchase agreement with Statkraft. That is very much market dependent on market conditions. I mean, it goes up and down, depends on winter, summer, and so on. But on balance, over the course of the year, it is also quite predictable. And then we've got the embedded benefits. And the main reason why we focus on 11 kV connected sites as opposed to 33 kV connected sites. So we're plugged into the distribution network, not the transmission network. So we actually get paid to generate, which is called embedded benefits. That adds a nice piece to our income stream as well. Although not guaranteed, you know, very predictable. And then there's the balancing mechanism. So I think, you know, all four together gives us a good diversified income stream.
Sorry, I had the next question in my head. Yes, okay. So in July, a few months ago, you raised £5 million. Can you describe how that 5 million was structured and how it positions the company financially going forward? And maybe in particular, why did you go for 5 million when potentially you could have raised slightly more, slightly less?
So the funding package was essentially a recapitalization of the business. I mean, we turned the business around operationally in 2024. We successfully proved concept with Firebridge, but we had a bit of a legacy drag, you know, on the balance sheet. And we felt that, you know, if the opportunity arose, let's recapitalize the business. You know, let's reset, let's settle, essentially settle PLC's debt. We've got a debt-free balance sheet that's got a lot of benefits and really ignite the business. So that's kind of, you know, the premise of the funding. The funding package is a fairly standard offering. So the investment group that offered this to us, you know, has done this before very successfully. So they've got a very good track record. And then it was an offering that we either took or didn't take, you know. So that's where the quantum comes from, the 5 million initial warrants tranche, and then there's a follow-on potential, a further 10 million in secondary warrants.
Right. And basically, almost they said, this is the money that we have to offer you to grow. Would you like the
Yes.
deal? And you said yes. Right.
That's exactly it. And I mean, you know, just kind of, you know, for a bit more context, if we look at the capital markets, small to micro cap, you know, fundraisers over the past 18 to 24 months, I think this is really an outlier. You know, it's one of the larger funding deals that happened. You know, so I don't think we should forget that the capital markets has really been challenging the past few years. And, you know, for us, it was either this you know, and it's got its pros and cons. But on balance, we believed it's really going to be beneficial and ignite the business, which, you know, it's proven to have done. Or kind of just keep battling forward like all the other smaller micro caps.
No, it's true. I think it is changing, though. I mean, like, you speak to anyone in the small cap, the past, I'm not talking back in July, but the past sort of 3-4 weeks, you're starting to see that, you know, capital coming back into the small cap market. Quite why that's the case, I think it's just cyclical, but also, you know, concerns with overvaluations of large caps, people looking for value, people looking for new ideas. I think in particular, because I do a lot of work with private equity, a lot of those guys are struggling with valuations down there and like to have money in, you know, things with, in companies with liquidity that are listed on a market. So you might see the IPO pipeline coming back as well. But, you know, we're going to finish off now with a few questions about the future. I want to start with the AI data center joint venture, because that looks transformative. It looks very different to, you know, what else you're doing. Why did you choose to get into the AI data center space? You know, obviously, I know that the UK is a global data center leader for AI, which I think is a bit strange given how high our energy costs are. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. How big could this AI data center joint venture become?
So when I looked at Med's, you know, growth path and our sources for growth, you know, being the brownfields and the greenfields, I mean, that's all fine. And then that's solid pieces of our puzzle. But I felt that, you know, there's more to be had. There's gaps in the UK energy demand market, which is not being addressed at the moment by anyone. And, you know, Mars could be the first mover in to fill those gaps. And one of the gaps that stood out, you know, like a sore eye to me was the AI data center energy demand gap. Because, I mean, the UK government's been very clear and vocal about their support for AI data center development growth. So that's going to be the energy demand. I think the numbers are clear. That's going to explode. But nobody's addressing that energy demand. So when I started looking into that, started speaking to AI data center developers in partnership with our joint venture partner, Carbon Zero Markets, you know, who's got a lot of these AI data center developer clients, they said that, you know, they don't know who to turn to address that problem. So, I mean, that's a really critical need in the UK market. I mean, these AI data centers at the moment are solely reliant on National Grid, which doesn't have a 100% track record. And the moment that they don't have power for a single second in a year, they get significant penalties. And that's where we step in. You know, so we give them the energy security. And then secondly, and that's kind of the ultimate benefit to us is, you know, we'll look to negotiate a private wire power purchase agreement with the AI data center at better terms than we can get merchant PPA with Statkraft. That's ultimately what we want to do.
Ultimately, better terms than obviously anything in the artificial intelligence space. You know, for want of a better phrase, it's just money sloshing around, isn't it?
Yes,
it just is.
Yes.
And the kind of money that you think is big money in different sectors is pocket change in artificial intelligence.
Yes.
I guess, you know, when you're looking at sort of the role that Mars is going to play in the UK's energy mix sort of over, you know, the next couple of decades, battery storage is becoming a bigger thing, green gas, potentially hydrogen, green hydrogen. So how are these all going to interplay with your long-term diversification strategy, particularly as energy, you know, battery storage becomes more and more prevalent?
So we're very excited about both those. So starting off with, you know, let's call it green gas, and whether that's hydrogen or biofuels, whatever the case may be, you know, we are already set up for that. So one of the reasons why we chose Yenbacker and more recently Rolls-Royce is our current gensets already green gas ready. So we can easily swap out LP gas with green gas and just, you know, continue as is. No further CapEx investment required. So we're very excited about that. I think there's a few challenges ahead for green gas in the UK, but hopefully that gets sorted.
A few might be an understatement. But
Exactly. But, you know, I think in due course, there's going to be solutions. And it might not be that the national gas grid is going to replace with green gas. I think there's going to be more likely going to be depots of green gas, you know, across the UK that we can tap into. And that's probably because, I mean, hydrogen's biggest challenge is the fact that it's very expensive to transport, as it's widely known. So until that problem has been cracked, I think, you know, depots and so on is going to be, it's going to be the solution. But so, I mean, that's green gas. On the battery side, we're also very excited about the technology there is advancing, you know, on a daily basis. We don't believe it's there quite yet, but we believe that it will get there. And yeah, we're ready. We're ready to plug into that as soon as we believe the technology versus the CapEx is at an attractive level.
And then, okay, so coming towards the end now, so we had an RNS out this morning, exclusive joint venture for Holiday Parks Power Supply. Holiday Parks, as you'll be able to explain, but in my mind, it's very simple. They want to keep the power on, and that's trickier than, you know, pretty much anywhere else in the market. So, I mean, basically, how did the idea come to you? Did somebody approach you, potentially? And what's the idea behind the joint venture? What's the strategy? Is there going to be premium pricing, for example?
Yes. So I think as with the AI data center strategy, we believe there's a significant gap in the market. You know, we've had Holiday Park developers and owners approach us very much like the AI data center developers and saying that, you know, there's this gap in the market and they don't know who to turn to. You know, in fact, that, you know, we're already in discussions with one of the UK's largest Holiday Park developers and owners, and they've shown us practical examples where they had blackouts. Imagine you're on a roller coaster, the power goes out, and you're stuck there for hours until, and you know, they don't have backup power necessarily. When you're stuck there, or you're in a hotel, the Holiday Park, you know, and the lights go out, you're busy, you know, making a meal or whatever the case may be. So there's a significant gap. So for us, the pitch is that, you know, we'll construct and provide them with a power security solution, which is a benefit to them. And for us, the benefit is like the AI data center at terms better than we can get in the market.
Yeah, I mean, kind of thinking ahead, basically what you're doing is you're providing an energy insurance policy, right, for individual sites. And so whether it's an AI data center where the energy goes off and that's incredibly expensive, or a holiday park where energy goes off and then potentially you're looking at holidaymakers filing claims for refunds or compensation. Yes. Does it make sense in the middle future to go into, you know, to go to talk to insurers potentially, rather than to go to individual sites to say, okay, you have a business that relies on energy being available 24/7. How can we, you know, interest you? Can we incentivize you? Can you go via the insurance market? Because to my mind, that's probably where you should be going long term. But maybe there's a reason you're not doing that.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Charles. And I think at the right scale, absolutely. You know, I think that will make sense. But in the meantime, to kind of just solidify that strategy, and again, like Bybridge, kind of, you know, do proof of concept, you know, we will start with individual sites. And then, as you say, I think the insurance market being kind of inherently the player makes a lot of sense.
Hmm. Okay, final question. I feel like you dodged that one, so I won't press you on it. But final question. If you're a potential investor and you're listening in, you've not heard about Mast Energy before, or maybe you've heard about it a little bit because obviously we've had a, you know, a decent share price run, and the share price is fairly volatile at the moment. It's jumping up and down, as stocks do when they've had a big run. Why should you consider investing in Mast now at this stage of your growth journey?
So I think investing now because we're at the start of our journey. So we've laid the foundation, we've proven concept, we've ticked those boxes, we've had those successes. We've got a very clear growth strategy that's diversified. We've got funding behind us. We've got the necessary partnerships in place. And our first target is 300 megawatts. We've got 5 megawatts in production at the moment. So there's significant upside to be had purely from that perspective. And I mean, that's only our first target, you know, in the short to medium term. If we're looking long term, you know, the numbers just get bigger. So I think, you know, getting in at the ground floor, so to speak, is never a bad idea.
Getting in at the ground floor is never a bad idea. Peter, lovely to chat to you. Hopefully we'll have another conversation in a month or two. Fantastic. Speak soon.
Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.